Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Emily shares her cancer story with Dr. Francine Foss.
So, Emily, we first met when you were given some bad news about a cancer diagnosis. Can you go back to that point in time and tell us a little bit about what happened and how you felt about it?
Yes, absolutely. In retrospect, I had the disease probably for 8 or 9 years before I met you. I started having a couple of lesions on my lower legs, two or three at a time, and they would come and go, and they were sort of innocuous looking. I went to a couple of dermatologists over the years, and they were unimpressed, and they didn't recommend any treatment. And because they would come and go, these lesions, I didn't give them a tremendous amount of thought. But in the spring of 2005, I started having more and more of the lesions, and the old ones didn't disappear. So at that point, I had a biopsy, and it was a little nonspecific, as I recall. But I finally saw you in August of 2005, and you, of course, took one look at me and said, "Aha! This is exactly what you have: the subcutaneous paniculitis-like T-cell and lymphoma," which was, of course, a terrible shock to receive. I was 46 years old. I thought of myself as a very active, very healthy, very physically fit person. So this was just sort of a tremendous adjustment to my understanding of who I was. I think you also said right away that I was going to need a bone marrow transplant, which was definitely something that was very hard to hear. I felt perfectly well. I couldn't imagine needing something so drastic as that. And I think I had the layperson's association with it, that if you'd asked me to sort of free associate on bone marrow transplantation, I would have said, last-ditch effort, terrible suffering, die anyway, which of course turned out, none of that turned out to be true. And I think if I'm thinking about sort of the most helpful thing that I could have known at that point was that it would be perfectly possible to lead a completely normal life after a bone marrow transplant.
And how many years has it been for you since the transplant?
Tomorrow it will be 4 years to the day.
Wow.
And I feel perfectly normal. I mean, I'm older, so I think I feel the effects of being older, but I am very active. I run 4 or 5 miles several days a week. No one looking at me would know I'd been through anything like that. I lift weights. I work normally. So my life I feel completely healthy.
You work full-time and you shepherd a couple of children also?
Yes. I have two daughters who were 15 and 17 at the time of my diagnosis. And that was hard because I one of my motivations for staying alive was feeling that they were much too young to lose a parent. And that was a very strong incentive. We made the decision at my instigation to not share with them the dark side as much as we might have. I kind of felt, at least at the early stages, that I had a good chance of living with the disease another number of years, since I'd seemed to have had it for so long, or even of being cured. And I thought, well, if things get really dicey, there will be time to warn them. But I wanted their lives to be as normal as possible. Of course, that's not fully possible. I mean, they saw me going through the chemo, and they saw me losing my hair, and they saw me getting very, very feeble. But I think knowing that we were going for a cure was very helpful to them, and they were incredibly, incredibly supportive.
So how did you actually break the news to them that you had cancer?
You know, I don't remember exactly. I think the initial thought after the first biopsy was it was a kind of cutaneous lymphoma, and I think the prospects were better. So we kind of just said, well, I'm going to need a lot of treatment, and I might lose my hair, but, you know, we're going to get through this. So we were very optimistic and very encouraging about it. And I know they were very worried, but I don't remember the specific moment when we actually sat down and told them.
How did you break the news to them that you'd need a bone marrow transplant?
You know, that again, it's funny. It's like the memory sort of puts a little cocoon around things like that. So the specifics of that, I don't know. I was very resistant to that idea from the very beginning. And I think there was a moment in the illness where I had to start being more frightened of the disease than of the treatment. And once that happened, then I was like very gung-ho to do whatever it took. Very shortly after finding out that I definitely needed a bone marrow transplant, we also found out that my brother was a perfect match. So that was very fortunate, and that made it much easier. And I think that's how we presented it to the girls. We said, well, I'm going to need this transplant, but luckily Uncle Jimmy is a perfect match, and it should go fine. And I think we just sort of always presented it that way, and they trusted us. But of course, I think it had to have been very unnerving for both of them. I've talked about it a lot with them since, and I think it was very hard.
So you talk a lot about going through an emotional roller coaster, starting out with these lumps that you've had for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden finding out that they were cancer. What was that moment like?
It really was very terrifying, and it was so discordant with what I felt about myself as a person that it was a complete kind of identity-shattering moment. I suddenly thought, I'm not in middle age. I'm an old, sick woman at the end of my life. And that was really a very, very hard thing to accept. But I think by nature an optimistic person, and there were always options. The initial options were not very threatening to me. I did 8 or 9 months of a treatment that was not terribly intrusive. I didn't have a lot of side effects from it, and I was able to incorporate it into the rest of my life. So it became very important to me to keep my sense of who I was as I went through it, and to think of all the things that mattered to me that I could still do. And that had to do with my relationships with my family and with my friends. I kept working for the first year and a half of chemotherapy, and that was crucial. I actually didn't tell very many people at work. I told a couple of people I had to tell, but in general, it was easier for me to continue working and not think about being ill at work until that became impossible. I had to take a leave of absence from work for about 2 years. As the chemotherapy ramped up, and then for the transplant itself.
So maintaining that place in reality, so to speak, helped you to adjust to this whole concept that you had this disease?
Yeah, I had to think of the disease as something that I had, something that I was experiencing, but not something that defined me. It wasn't who I was, it was what I was doing at the moment. And that was an important sort of balancing act. And I wasn't always successful at that, but I realized that a lot of what I was experiencing was in my control, in the sense that I could control my mental state. I could decide what to think about when. And the mental aspects of this are much, much harder than any of the physical aspects. I mean, the physical aspects do get difficult, but the really overwhelming part is the mental part. And I found that a lot of that was in my control. So I could just say, well, I know what's happening next. I've made my decision. I'm just not going to think about that right now. And I had to sort of narrow my focus very much to the moment I was in and think, what am I doing now? What can I do now? What would I like to do right this very minute? And try not to think about the big picture, because the big picture was very overwhelming.
So you essentially took it one step at a time.
Very, very much so. Really, really one minute at a time, just staying very focused on the present. I would read a book or listen to music if I was up for that, or watch a DVD or talk to a friend. I had to be isolated for a lot of it, particularly right after the transplant, and I relied very heavily on email and on the telephone. So I didn't, in fact, feel isolated because I could still communicate with people. And in some ways, it was easier to communicate that way because I could be more myself if I wasn't worried about how people were reacting to seeing me, because I knew I looked very ill.
So you said that you actually worked for the beginning part of the treatment. How was it to go to work and have to kind of pretend that you were like everyone else and you weren't getting chemotherapy?
It was a relief, because I didn't have to talk about it with anyone. I didn't have to have people coming up to me and saying, how are you? You know, I could just act normally. And it was also, my work is mentally very absorbing, so I was very distracted by it. And I would really go hours, days at a time and sort of be driving home and think, oh, wow, I didn't even think about the fact that I am sick all day. And that was really a relief. It was very nice.
You talk about control, and I think control is a big thing that a lot of cancer patients feel that they've lost after they get the diagnosis, and certainly when they start going through chemotherapy or other treatment that's rough, it's really easy to lose control. So did you always feel that you had control from the beginning, or did you kind of figure out as you were going through the process that, you know, actually you did have control?
It's sort of an odd balancing act. In some sense, you have to take the control that you can take. And for me, that involved sort of controlling my own thoughts. But in other ways, you sort of have to give yourself up to it and just say, okay, it's out of my control. I'm just going to give myself over to that. I really can't do anything right now but lie here, so that's okay. I'm just going to do that. So I never really felt that I took control of the process. The most that I felt was that I could take control of my own thoughts and how I was processing things. And I also had very wise advice from another friend of mine who was going through a similar adventure. And I said, you know, every time I get bad news, I fall apart. And I can't seem to prepare myself for that. And she said, you have to accept that that's the case. You can't prepare yourself. And you're going to fall apart when you get bad news. And then you're going to pull yourself together and say, okay, now I'll deal with this new reality. Because there was a period in the early stages when I thought, oh, maybe this nice drug that doesn't make me feel too ill is actually going to cure me. And it did do very well for a time, but then it stopped working, and that was quite devastating. But I think just knowing that it was okay to fall apart when I got bad news, and then to realize that I would then cope with the new reality as it became clear what that was. So I don't think I ever actually took control of the process, but I've got better at sort of giving up control.
And you also allowed yourself to fall apart, because that's an important part. Everybody has to allow themselves to do that.
That was very hard for me, because I am sort of a controlled person. I'm not particularly spontaneous, and I don't really like unexpected adventures. I had tremendous help in all of this from not only my family and friends, but I must say the people at Yale were absolutely extraordinary, the doctors, the nurses. One of the fringe benefits of this whole experience was seeing the absolute best side of human nature. That is the kindness and the compassion and the generosity that I received from the nurses and doctors at the hospital. And these were people I'd only ever met as a patient. So they didn't even know me, and they were just so incredibly kind. So I'm extremely grateful. I would not be here if it weren't for you and all the people who work with you. So I'm very grateful for that.
So Emily, we're going to have to take a break right now for a medical minute, and we'll be back to hear more about your story and particularly more about your transplant.
The American Cancer Society estimates that last year there were over 65,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and over 1,000 patients are diagnosed annually in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. And new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined today by my guest, Emily, who is a patient who's experienced lymphoma, had a bone marrow transplant, and is now a long-term survivor. We were talking a little bit at the beginning of the show about the whole the diagnosis of cancer and how you felt and the process that you went through to kind of accept all of what was happening to you. And certainly it was one thing to have to accept the diagnosis and then the treatment, but the other part for you is that you had to undergo a bone marrow transplant. Can you tell us what you thought when that was first mentioned to you?
My first reaction, because it came on the same day that I was diagnosed with the disease, was just sort of shock and horror and disbelief. It seemed like such a drastic approach to what I'd been living with for 8 or 9 years and thought of as not life-threatening. So it was a gradual adjustment. And I think I said earlier that I had to get to the point where I was more frightened of the disease than of the treatment. And once I got to that point, then I was really understood that in order to eradicate the disease, I needed the transplant. Then I really was enthusiastic and eagerly awaiting the moment when you told me that I was in remission and that I could, in fact, go forward with the transplant.
Most people think about a bone marrow transplant as being the absolute last thing, and I think that's what you thought as well. Were you scared that a transplant would be something that would kill you?
You know, it's funny. I think my mind was, at that point, I was so clear that the disease was going to kill me that I didn't really allow myself to think that I could die during the transplant. What I was afraid was that it would leave me a complete invalid and that I would have no quality of life after it. But what I had recognized, I think, going through the whole process and since, is that quality of life is largely dependent on mental attitude, and some of that is in my control. Not all of it, but some of it. It's actually funny. It was only about a year after the transplant that I sort of thought, you know, I could have died just going through that process. But I was so fixed on the goal, and that's one of the sort of mental images that helped me a lot was thinking of myself as a freight train, that I was just going to barrel down the tracks and I wasn't going to let anything deflect me. Nothing was going to knock me over. So I think I went through the transplant really without allowing myself to think about the risks of actually dying during it.
Can you talk about how hard the transplant was compared to the chemotherapy, or maybe it was the same?
No, actually, as difficult as the chemotherapy was, and I had 5-day inpatient treatments separated by 16 days at home, and I had 8 of those, and that was quite challenging. The transplant made that seem like a vacation at the beach. I have to say the transplant was unimaginably more difficult than that. I had no idea. I don't know that anyone could have told me in advance. The big thing was the fatigue, the weakness. I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and when I came home, I spent 6 weeks on the sofa. I literally could not get off the sofa except to go to the day hospital for the blood tests and support treatment that I definitely needed. So I literally lay still for 6 months, and I was not prepared for that. That was very difficult.
When did you actually feel like you were better?
Well, I was able to drag myself off the sofa at 6 months, and I discovered that I had 2 frozen shoulders. And I went to the physical therapist at that point. It was the first time I was really able to do that. And I discovered that I had lost 80% of the range of motion in my left shoulder and 90% of the range of motion in my right shoulder. And the thing that was most shocking was when the therapist said to me, well, how long has your mobility been impaired? And I realized I had no idea. So I had been too ill to notice that I couldn't move my arms. That's how weak I was. And I did pretty intensive physical therapy to get my mobility back. I did regain all of it. So I would say it was a year out. I remember that the nurses made a big deal about the 100 days, and you have, because I had to go to the day hospital, I think, 3 times a week for the first 100 days, and that was a huge milestone. And I remember sort of looking at my mother and thinking, wow, I still feel terrible, and it was 100 days out. But I tried to be active. That's the other thing. During the chemo and during the transplant, it really was important to me, both physically and mentally, to stay active. So I think even when I was really on the sofa, I would drag myself off the sofa for 5 minutes to just sort of walk around the living room. And that was crucial.
That's a really important point for patients who don't feel good is, you know, when do you decide that, yeah, I don't feel good, but I really need to get up and do something? And when do you say, well, gee, I don't feel good, I need to rest?
It's sort of trial and error. I think for me, it had to do with if I pushed myself to do something. I mean, I remember there's a period where I could just walk like once around the backyard. And then when I lay down again, did I feel better or worse? If I felt a little better, then I thought it was a good move. If I felt worse, then I thought, okay, maybe that was too much.
So now you're a survivor. You've been 4 years. You've been cancer-free for that long. But you've had to come in and get these scans done. And I know you've always been anxious about the scans.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how you felt when you had that first scan after the transplant? And how do you feel now when you have your scans?
Well, I think because my disease was always visible, or at least part of it was always visible, it gave me, when I didn't see any of the lesions on my skin, it gave me some confidence to think that, well, maybe it hadn't come back. And as time went on and I didn't see, but I still, I mean, I had a mosquito bite last week that I was freaking out about because that's how innocuous these lesions looked. So until that went away, I knew it was a mosquito bite. I could see it, it itched, and, you know, but just seeing a lump on my skin was a very alarming thing. The scans are hard. Just waiting for test results is very, very hard. And I just have to use that technique. I'm not going to think about it right now. I'm going to go through it, do it, and I'll cope with the results.
Is it hard to come back into the hospital? Is it hard to go up to the transplant floor? Does that bring back memories? Is that unpleasant for you?
You know, I have not yet been I want to go back and thank all the nurses, and I haven't yet been able to do that. It's been 4 years. I do have, I think, a sort of a post-traumatic stress response to the hospital. Just walking into the hospital, I feel nauseous. So that's hard. And there are certain aisles in the supermarket where I'll see foods that I had to use when I was sick, and I just get that same sort of visceral reaction. So, I mean, it's in some sense, you do feel more vulnerable after an experience like this, so I think it's made me somewhat more fragile.
Do you think about yourself as a cancer survivor? Is that something that's on your mind day to day?
No, I really don't. I think that was something I experienced. I went through it. I try not to frame it that way. I think that's not helpful for me. Maybe it is for some people, but for me, that's not helpful.
So what's been the most important thing for you in your recovery phase, post having been through all of this, as you're recovering now to go back to your life? What are the important things?
Well, the surprising realization that in some ways life can be much better after an experience like that. It certainly does help me to keep my priorities straight. I can be stuck in a terrible traffic jam and think, I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to be upset about this. I survived a bone marrow transplant. and just being able to laugh about something like that, it can be very helpful. It's a little bit like trying to hold water in your hand. You have to keep trying, but it does give me a frame of reference so that I try to make sure that I concentrate on what's really worth concentrating on, and I don't sweat the small stuff as much as I used to. That's definitely true.
Can you talk about how your life has changed as a result of this? How things have changed at work, how things have changed at home?
You know, I'm one of those people, I like my routines, so I've kind of gone back to a lot of my normal life. I think I'm a better friend and a better parent and a better wife because of what I've been through. I think I'm more empathetic and I'm more sensitive to other people's needs. I had a wonderful life before I got sick. And I'm very fortunate to have a wonderful life now. I loved my family. I loved my work. So to be able to resume that has been a tremendous gift. I don't think every day I'm a cancer survivor. I'm a cancer survivor, but it's definitely in some level on my mind. Every moment is really precious. Every moment is a gift. I don't take anything for granted.
Do you ever not worry about relapsing, or is that something that a cancer survivor always has at the back of their mind?
You know, I was always an anxious person, and I think I was always afraid of illness. But it's there's a big difference between being sort of diffusely anxious and having a very clear and specific idea of what there is to be anxious about. So that's the constant challenge. And when I find myself having these sort of circular anxious thoughts, I just say, no, I'm not going to think about that now. I think the way I've framed it to myself is that I have a good chance of getting some new cancer. So why fear the old one? there just doesn't seem to be any benefit in worrying about that.
Did you ever go to support groups, or are there specific books that you read that helped you along the way?
No, I never did support groups. That's not something that I find helpful. I do read a lot, and I find reading in general very helpful. As far as specific things, I mean, just sort of specific individual quotes from different people that I found very helpful that I sort of kept in mind as sort of mantras. So for me, reading was either distraction or a way to sort of focus my energies.
You had the unique opportunity to get bone marrow from your brother. How did that change your relationship with him?
You know, my brother and I are very close, but when we were children, we fought a lot. And I remember telling a friend of mine who'd known us, and we'd been friends in high school, and I said, you know, the strangest thing about this is that Jimmy and I are a perfect match. And she looked at me and she said, yeah, and you were hoping you weren't even related. So, we were able to laugh about it. It's brought us definitely closer, but we were already close by the time we were in college. We were already close. It was an incredibly generous thing that he did. We were just at my younger daughter's graduation from college, and my brother was there, and I was sitting next to him, and I just thought, I'm only here because of you.
I remember initially he was a little apprehensive just because he didn't understand the process, but I think that after he went through it, he felt like it was pretty easy.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of nice. I wasn't asking him for a kidney. I think it would have been harder for me to ask for a kidney, but this was something that I understood was not going to compromise the quality of his life, and he was willing to do whatever it took, but I was glad that it didn't require anything. It wasn't, especially now that you don't want bone marrow per se. It was just stem cells. So it was a couple of days of discomfort for him, but that's all.
And one of the issues we face is that a lot of our patients don't actually have family donors, and we have to go to the unrelated bone marrow transplant registry. Would you have felt the same way if you had an unrelated donor? Would that have made any difference to you?
Well, I was glad that a full sibling donor was a good match, but I think a donor that's a good match is a good match, and that's the issue. And I wouldn't even feel that it was a great imposition on a donor. If I were someone whose marrow was desirable, I would have no qualms about donating because it seems as if it's not a particularly invasive process.
And I think your story really should reach out to people in the community who haven't thought about donating yet, that donating bone marrow can really lead to success stories like Emily's.
Oh yeah! If you haven't been tested, please do so, because it's a minor imposition on you, and you can save somebody's life.
Are there any pearls or tidbits that you would like to throw out there for people that are going through what you're going through, or people that are just getting a diagnosis of cancer?
I guess I would just say, just remember who you are and try to be that person as you're going through it. Try to find humor whenever you can. Humor is very helpful. Try to stay physically active as much as you can. I was lifting weights in between chemo cycles and walking. So do what you can do to keep your identity.
And also, I think you were doing some other things. Emily was very physically active and did a few things that her doctor told her not to do while she was getting chemotherapy, but we ended up making it through.
Yes, I'm a horseback rider, and I remember my horse took advantage of my frailty at one point and tossed me, and I ended up with 3 fractured ribs and a punctured lung, and I remember how thrilled you were with that.
And that wasn't long after the transplant.
But that was important for me to stay me. That really was a part of my identity that I was not ready to give up. And so being able to connect to my horse, even on the days when I could just go up and visit with him and not actually ride, that was very important to my mental well-being.
That's Emily, and we'd like to thank her for sharing her cancer story with Dr. Francine Foss. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.